Hey everyone, welcome back to Troubled, a podcast by survivors of institutional abuse for survivors and the general public. Reminder, per usual, we're getting this a lot, so I just really want to remind you guys, there's trigger warnings on everything. If magically it's not a trigger warning episode, we'll let you know. But, you know, just per the beast, we are always discussing mass, for-profit, legal, child abduction, detainment, abuse, and murder. So please keep that in mind. Today, we are not speaking with a survivor, so hopefully it isn't as graphically triggering as it has been recently. But this episode is by far my favorite episode. And I think a lot of times when I want to give us credit as a podcast and as an information engine, and I'm like, everybody should love us. I don't understand why we only have like 18 rating reviews on Apple. Like, what's up? It's because I forget y'all have never heard this episode. So this episode, again, my favorite, is with the amazing Erin McGinnis of Children's Rights. We're going to get all into who Children's Rights are, but please check out their website. Dig deep after you get off this episode. But this is incredibly informative. Erin is amazing. Children's Rights is amazing. And there's so much information that, you know, I operate with now that I had no idea about until this episode. So I'm sorry it's been in the vault since July. But, you know, when we were really focused on the Cornelius Frederick situation, not that we're not focused, but when we were really heated up in Michigan and interaction with all those people, that's basically what happened. We had a couple conversations about, you know, some cases that are currently open. We were hoping to wait until it was legally appropriate for us to keep all the content in, or, you know, get some magical edit that allowed us to say the same things but not say the same things. And you know what? We've waited long enough. We definitely need you guys to all know who Children's Rights are so that you can get involved. And this information is completely invaluable about the foster care system. It just blows my mind. And so I think that when we're talking to people about abolition versus all the other options in the reform model, I'm not sure that you guys have the information you need to be making those decisions and taking those stands, but here it is. So enjoy, and per the wham bam thank you ma'am moments that we all kind of just wanted to find a way to include in this episode, Children's Rights will be giving us updates as some of the cases that we discuss become open to the public, which some of them should be pretty soon. So hopefully we will be able to share that with you. But, you know, link up with them, hashtag free our youth. All of their socials will be in the description, and their website's in the description, childrensrights.org. And then I will do it in the outro because I know you're not gonna remember anything I just said. All right, let's go. Let's do this. Thank you. Erin McGinnis from Children's Rights, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So as we've talked about already, there's so much information to what you guys are doing. And I myself was completely ignorant that you were out there championing the cause. So could you just introduce yourself to our troubled tribe and explain what Children's Rights is, how long you guys have been around, and what you do?
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Erin McGinnis. I'm a senior policy analyst for Children's Rights, as you mentioned. Children's Rights is a nonprofit organization that advocates on behalf of systems-involved youth across the country. So traditionally, we've advocated on behalf of foster youth, and we also do work on behalf of children involved in the juvenile justice system, Medicaid, ensuring access to medically necessary and appropriate medical treatment, access to education, especially special education. And we've done some limited work in immigration.
Exactly my point with there's so much stuff you guys are doing. Okay, so I've looked at this and it looks like you're tackling a lot of this from a class action lawsuit perspective. So tell me about that, because it looks like are you suing the states themselves on behalf of these children? Is that how this works?
So oftentimes, yes. So we do advocacy to protect the rights of youth that are dependent on systems. And one of the advocacy tools that we will use is the power of the courts. And so oftentimes that is a class action litigation to bring systemic reform. So when we sue for an injunction, meaning we want policy change. So our win would be to stop hurting the kids in care. So oftentimes this is against states or any jurisdiction. It really just depends on the individual case, whoever has the custody and control of the youth that are being hurt in that area.
So per your jurisdiction point, because I think that's where it often gets fun, on a super macro level, and it's fun because you guys are called children's rights, but in my personal experience and a lot of the survivors of these residential programs, whether they were in-state care originally or otherwise, it doesn't really feel like children in the U.S. do have rights. So do they have state rights? Do they have federal rights? Are these alleged rights children have based on like the UN? And, you know, start there, because what are these rights?
For sure, for sure. So, I mean, children are people. And children in the United Agreed. States are people that have rights under the U.S. Constitution, just like every other adult in the United States has rights under the Constitution. And that includes substantive due process. That includes the right to not be hurt by your government. So for foster care, for example, if the government makes a choice to bring you into foster care, they've become your parent. They owe a duty to protect you, to make sure you are safe, to make sure that your needs are being met. And when that's not happening, that's a violation of your constitutional rights. And so we would make sure that those rights were protected and enforced.
Is there an age limit on this? Because what we're seeing in a lot of these age out programs is that prior to the age of 18, or, you know, I'm sure it varies in some states, these kids don't have the ability to even reach out for support from someone like you or even CPS, sometimes even their parents. So when is that line of when I have rights? And is it sometimes just like a retroactive thing that once I turn 18, I can look at, or how does that work?
Oh, yikes. No, every person has rights. You always have rights. Unfortunately, it might be more challenging for a young person to exercise their rights. And we see this time and time again. It's really easy for governments to ignore the rights of young people, right? So because they're under 18, they don't vote. If they're in foster care, they may not have parents that are voting on their behalf. So it's an easy population to sweep under the carpet. And sometimes it may feel that they don't have rights, but that's absolutely not true. Of course they have rights. And that's sort of where we try to step in and fill that void where, you know, there may not be folks advocating for this group as a whole. So we try to make sure, we serve as a watchdog to make sure that those rights are not being ignored. You can't just sweep young people under the rug.
Right, because it doesn't seem like your position of proactive advocacy ends after litigation. Like with example with Michigan, with Duane versus Snyder. Do you want to, I had not heard about this until we started looking into Michigan per all the sequel jazz, but can you like briefly to a layperson explain what Duane versus Snyder was in Michigan and how, like what happened there?
Yeah, for sure. So this is an example of what we were just talking about. So we work typically with grassroots organizations within different states or jurisdictions. And so when we hear that there are youth who are system dependent, who are being hurt or having their rights violated by the state, that's typically when we'll get involved. And so in Michigan, this was regarding their foster care system. We did an investigation and we found out that, you know, thousands of kids in foster care were just not being cared for. Their needs were not being met. They were experiencing maltreatment within the foster care system. It was just a real mess. And so we brought a class action lawsuit. So we represented a class of all of the children, all of the young people that were in the Michigan foster care system statewide. And we actually settled with the state. So we came to an agreement with the state of Michigan that said that the state of Michigan would make reforms to their foster care system from this point moving forward. And there was a list of agreed upon reforms, and it covered all sorts of touch points to the foster care systems. And all of this is available. This is all on our website. You can Google it if you wanted to read the entire agreement. And so, for example, one of them is maltreatment in care, meaning children who are currently in foster care in the state of Michigan have to be safe in their placement. And so that's an example of one of the types of reforms that we would work on. Now this happened, I mean, Michigan was 2008. So this is, you know, 12 years ago. To reform a institution as large as a foster care system takes time. And so we've been working with Michigan now for over 10 years. We've been involved with that state trying to reform their foster care system. We use the term congregate care facility to refer to any foster care placement that's not a family home. So group home, therapeutic group home, residential facility. It's an umbrella term to refer to all of those non-family living situations. There are all sorts of policies and best practices regarding the use of restraints in residential facilities. And so first of all, restraints should never be used unless a young person is posing harm to themselves or others. This is not something that should ever be used in a punitive context. It should never be used for intimidation purposes. That's never an appropriate use of a restraint. A restraint has to be a last-ditch effort at maintaining safety for the residents, period. Any other use of a restraint is automatically an inappropriate restraint. And then within the restraints, they have to be performed safely in a way that will restrain the harmful and dangerous behavior without actually hurting the young person or the person administering the restraint. Obviously, that's not what happened in Cornelius's case. As we all know, the restraint was used punitively and was used dangerously and was used over aggressively. And so all of those are very clear violations of restraint policy and best practice.
And I'm assuming it wasn't just in regard to restraint, though, because then I also see that you guys stayed in play by monitoring the traction here. And you released a report also, or were part of that, that showed how Michigan had, put these reforms into play. And how did that go? Because it did not look to me like they were hitting all the marks there.
Yeah. So after we come to agreements with the state, or after a trial will end, then the reform process actually begins. And so usually what happens is, as I said, reforms can take years. So the jurisdiction will undergo a series of policy changes, and then there's usually check-in points along the way to monitor the progress. And so we are not, hands-on doing the reform. The state is doing the reform that they are now under court order to do, but there are periodic reports or data publication or some form of transparency into the progress of that reform process. So in the case of Michigan, it's a monitoring report. So there's an independent monitor that reviews their data and their progress, and every 6 months publishes a report outlining how far along they've come, what they have improved on, where they are along the way, what they still need to improve on, et cetera. And those are all become publicly available documents to improve transparency and so that everybody knows what's going on in the system.
Okay, so I don't want to, Emma warned me about getting too deep into the Duane v. Snyder because it's like its own rabbit hole. So you guys have all of this stuff on your website so people can just dig in and self-educate, right? Where can they find that?
For sure. They can go to our website, childrensrights.org, and every individual case that we're involved in, including Duane v. Snyder, is listed on our website. You can see the most recent monitoring reports, recent press, anything that you'd love to know. Those are all updates. You can also join our email listserv or Twitter, follow us on Twitter or Facebook, and then you can get real-time updates on any of the issues or individual cases that we're working on. If you have a particular interest in any of our issue areas, for sure, check that out.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, because our team, our peoples are really big into diving down these rabbit holes. So I hope they'll get sucked in as we have, because this is absolutely fascinating. I didn't know that this whole so we're mostly into the whole residential programs that target, the therapeutic jazz. I had foster kids in my program. Everybody mostly had foster kids in their program, but we didn't realize what a huge funnel it was from the foster care industry, or that this conversation was being had or needed to be escalated. And a portion of the conversation with foster care that I wanted to have with you is that it looks like there is a large portion of children going into institutionalized or congregate care facilities that it looks like experts are looking at and saying they shouldn't have been removed from their home in the first place. I mean, is that true? Is this just in Michigan? Is this national? What do you have to say about that?
So there's a lot to unpack there. And okay. I'm going to start by saying yes to everything you said. And this is at a national level. This happens everywhere. So with regard to going into institutional care, there's no reason for a child to be in a group home or any congregate care setting unless there's a true therapeutic need that can't be met in a family. And that's understood across the board. All of the psychological organizations, all of the child welfare organizations have unanimously agreed that children belong in families. Children do best in families. Children learn how to form and maintain meaningful relationships, how to really thrive when they are in a family setting. And I know on your podcast, you guys have discussed a lot of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. There have been studies that show that having a meaningful relationship with even just one adult that you trust in your life can overcome the effect of multiple ACEs. That's how important it is to make sure that our young people are in families, with adults that care about them, not in institutions with shift workers where there's, you know, the inability to really have that mentorship, to feel loved. And so this is understood. And the federal government has held in federal law that when a young person comes into foster care, they need to be in the most family-like setting that is capable of meeting their needs. That's the actual law. So it's inconceivable that 1 in 10 young people end up in a congregate care facility in our country. There's just no reason for that. Now, I do want to pause. There are some therapeutic congregate care facilities that are necessary, that do serve a medical function and do need to be on the continuum of care. And so when I'm referring to congregate care, I'm referring to non-therapeutic group homes that only serve as a receptacle for children because there wasn't a foster home or because we couldn't bother to put that child in a foster home, just as by way of clarification.
Are you also though seeing children that are not, that aren't being appropriately placed, that are being placed in therapeutic facilities, long-term facilities that you guys don't think should have been placed there either?
So yes, that also happens. Okay. Really what we're seeing is that when there's not a sufficient placement array, and by that I mean when there isn't the amount and appropriate variety of foster homes available to meet the needs, jurisdictions will scramble, they'll triage, they'll just put kids in whatever bed they can find rather than finding an appropriate match for that child. The idea is that when a child comes into foster care, you have an appropriate placement array that exists so that the social worker can find the home that will meet the needs of that child on an individual basis. And then the child can go into a family home that is appropriately matched to that child and have meaningful relationships until it's time to leave foster care. What we see is that children are coming in and going to whatever bed is available, regardless of the needs of the child, regardless of whether that bed is capable of meeting that child's needs. And unfortunately, that just can compound the trauma that this young person's already experienced.
Right. Well, and, you know, on that other level of should they have been removed from the environment in the first place, we're seeing, I mean, there are TED Talks with foster care directors explaining that there's apparently a conversation happening that I was completely ignorant to about whether foster care is inevitably you know, a predator, if you will, or, you know, it makes the initial error in the first place, without getting into any personal opinions. And I personally don't have one, formulated yet. But as we're going to be having this conversation, can you explain to people? It seems like there's two main viewpoints. It seems like there's people who want to reform, do a lot of the reform work that's being done, like with these litigations and with these new, you know, standards, or not new standards, but enforcing standards of care. And then there's also this group that's more radical that is looking to abolish the system entirely. Could you just like summarize that for us?
Yeah, for sure. And I'm so glad you asked this question. I think this is such an important part of this conversation. And you're right. We need to be discussing it more. So it is well settled and very well understood within the child welfare community and with, you know, within folks that practice in this area, that a child should only come into foster care. The specific laws are going to be a little bit different in every state, but generally speaking, it's if the child's in imminent danger. So there should be a real reason to bring that child into care. Poverty is never a reason to bring a young person into foster care. Full stop. However, we know that 60% of the children that enter foster care because of neglect, not because of child abuse, not because of, you know, these extreme cases that everyone tends to think of because of, you know, TV and the movies, and everyone thinks of kids in foster care as being abused. And yes, that happens, and it's horrific. But for 60% of the kids coming in, they are there for neglect. And neglect, we find, is really often just code for poverty. So what we see is a system that is essentially criminalizing poverty by taking children from their families and then putting them into a system that doesn't have the capacity to care for them until they get pushed out. And the whole thing is really quite bonkers. So the conversation that you were talking about is, you know, should we even be removing children in the first place? Well, 60% of the time, the answer is no. This is an issue of poverty and would better be addressed in the community, meeting these families' needs in their community with trauma-informed, community-based, culturally appropriate family prevention services. And we're starting to see the conversation shift in that direction, which is encouraging. We'd love to see more. It should, you know, we'd love to really be screaming this off the rooftops that children should not be in foster care for poverty, ever. I'm sorry if that's repetitive. I will probably say that 100 more times over the course of this podcast.
Well, it sounds like it's about time that the broken record play, like you said, on the rooftops, because if you're telling me that 60% of the time they shouldn't have been removed, and if this is a poverty issue, then I'm concerned that this is a class warfare issue. And then if it's a poverty and class issue, can you speak to the disparity for people of color? Because I'm afraid that's what's coming next.
It's absolutely what was coming next. I do want to clarify, 60% of the removals were for neglect, not for poverty. But we often, those of us that work in this field know that neglect is often code for poverty. But I just wanted to clarify that.
Right.
Yes. So of course we've been seeing tremendous racial disparity within the child welfare system. So 53% of Black parents will be investigated by CPS at some point. 53%. That is absurd. And so we do see even just the investigation can be invasive. You know, you have a social worker show up at your home that tells you you've been accused of mistreating your children, and they're going to, you know, interview your neighbors and your kids' teachers and the pediatricians, and now your whole life is uprooted, and they're dangling this threat of taking your kids over your head. It's an incredibly invasive and traumatic experience, and the numbers show that it's also incredibly racist. These are families that are being unduly and unnecessarily targeted. And lo and behold, we have a disproportionate amount of children entering foster care as a result of these racist and classist policies. And then the children within the foster care system being funneled into congregate care facilities, again, which is a huge racial disproportionality as to children that end up in congregate care facilities versus children that end up in family homes. So you see it at every level within this system. Absolutely.
Whew, that's really scary, because this is really feeling like assimilation in a lot of ways. And are the Indigenous, the First Nations, being targeted at an undue ratio as well?
So it's interesting that you mentioned the Indigenous. There is a law called the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA, that's specifically designed to protect the forced assimilation of Native children for this exact reason, because this is exactly what was happening. And so under federal law, when a child is taken into foster care, you're not allowed to take that child's race or ethnicity into consideration when deciding a placement match, right? You don't want to see instances where different children of different races and ethnicities are being treated differently with regard to placement. Now, we know that happens, but under federal law, that should not happen. The exception is when you have a Native child, the process for placement of Native children is unique. So when a Native child is taken into foster care, first, I should say, tribes in the United States have the option of running their own child welfare system. So if there's a tribe within any particular state, they can opt out of the state's child welfare system and opt to have their own. For tribes that don't, or for Native children that don't live on the actual tribal lands, when they come into foster care, the foster care agency must first give the tribe the option of placing the child within the tribe. If and only if the tribe declines to physically take the child into their own system, they must place the child in a family that is a member of the tribe, of the same tribe as the child. If and only if there is no home available that is the same of the same tribe, then the agency must place the child with a Native family from a different tribe, any tribe at that point. And then if and only if there is no tribal family available to take that child, then they may place the child in a home in a non-tribal family. So, and that law was designed specifically to combat forced assimilation, to protect Native children.
But is that law working? Because I'm still seeing a ton of kids a lot younger than myself in Canada and in the US who are still going into residential placement and boarding schools and whatnot.
Sure. I can't speak to Canada. Unfortunately, our work at Children's Rights is only in the United States. And I can't speak to specific instances or anecdotal examples, unfortunately. We do know that ICWA is still in full force and effect, and to what fidelity it is being implemented very well may depend on individual states or counties or jurisdictions.
Is it research? So there's so much about the foster care system at large, and also, like, with the racial demographics, of course, and the class demographics nationally. You mentioned people can look into a ton of it on your website, but it's all over the place now that we've gone down the rabbit hole. But I don't see as much looking into the Indigenous communities. Is this because of the separations between the tribal oversight and just the way the federal jazz works?
Yeah, partially, I think so. I can't give you a specific example of where it may or may not be working. I don't know if I can answer that question. I don't think I know the specific example.
I don't either. And that's what's like so interesting to me, is because there's so many different aspects of this stuff where you can see so much data and there's been so much poking around, and then there's other areas where it's like, we don't know yet, and I'm just not sure why we don't know.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. That's another tricky area you mentioned is data. Is a lot of this, it's hard to have very accurate data, right? Because we're talking about children, we're talking about people. And so there is some rudimentary data that is collected by the federal government that's aggregated, and you may or may not have it 2 years later, but it's really it's really up to the local child welfare agency to maintain data, and they do with more or less efficiency in different places. So there's a lack of consistency of data across the board.
So is there any federal oversight for children's rights, or is, and also within the foster care system specifically, or is everything state by state?
So that's an interesting question. So foster care is a state and federal partnership. The program itself is a state and federal partnership where the federal government partially funds states to run a child welfare system, and they get reimbursed based on a number of factors, and it's up to the state to design and run the program. So each state has a different child welfare system. You'll never see two child welfare systems that are identical, and that was designed that way intentionally. So there are certain oversight mechanisms that the federal government has. They'll do reviews, child and family service reviews, every handful of years, where there's a deep dive into different performance areas, and then states have to give an annual update. But there's no real teeth to the oversight, you know, because all of this, the enforcement mechanism that the federal government would have at its disposal is to withhold funding. And that's sort of a double-edged sword, right? If you withhold funding from a child welfare agency, you're taking money away from an agency that's probably already underfunded but needs it to support the children, and you're taking away money because you didn't believe they were supporting the children. So that sort of also gets a little dicey. So for all intents and purposes, there is no federal oversight on these child welfare agencies, which is sort of where Children's Rights steps in to fill that void. We consider ourselves a watchdog in this space to enforce the rights of children, because there really isn't any other mechanism to enforce that the child welfare agencies are performing appropriately.
So since you guys are a federal watchdog, and again, not sure if you can answer this question, you guys, it's been so much fun because, you know, legal things have to be taken into consideration, right? So I have to like actually think about my questions. Per your point of foster care being state by state, have you guys found a state that's doing it right, or is doing it the best, or one that you would look at as like kind of a model for how the other states should reform?
I knew you were gonna ask that question. So because every state does it differently, it's hard to do an exact model, because there might be a certain states that's performing well in one area, or another state that's performing well in another area. But generally speaking, we had a case in the state of Tennessee many, many years ago, and then worked through with them through a reform process. And they actually ended their consent decree. They exited out of their reform process because they had complied with all of the reforms that they had set into place, and now have one of the most efficient child welfare agencies at a state level in the country.
So you're not babysitting Tennessee anymore?
We don't babysit any of our jurisdictions. But we do continue to ensure that the reforms that they promised they would make, and that they are now court ordered to make, actually go into effect.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but one of those with Tennessee that I thought was really exciting was something about multiple children in a family hadn't, like there was a percentage hadn't been placed in homes or facilities together. And then that changed exponentially. Is that correct? You want to tell people what that was about?
Yeah. So one of the many problems in child welfare is that when kids come into care, oftentimes you'll have siblings that come out of the same home. And so if you have siblings, ideally you want, I mean, these kids just got removed from their parents. You at least want to keep the brothers and sisters together. But as we discussed before, that doesn't always happen, because oftentimes it's put the kid in the bed. And so if you don't have multiple beds, if you don't have a home that has the capacity to take in a sibling set, then oftentimes, unfortunately, we see these siblings get separated. And so if they have to be separated as a last resort, at least have the kids have visits, you know, have them have some semblance of continuation of these relationships. You know, for God's sakes, we're talking about kids. Let them see their brothers and sisters. But that just wasn't happening. So kids were coming into care. They were getting ripped from their families. They were getting ripped from each other. And then they weren't even seeing each other or allowed to continue their relationships with each other. And so that was a pretty, serious point of focus for us in Tennessee. As we said, you gotta do better. You gotta make sure that at least the brothers and sisters can stay together while they're in foster care. And they did. They really made tremendous progress in making sure that they were recruiting and retraining foster families that had the capacity to take in sibling sets or had creative workarounds where sibling sets could still be together and have meaningful relationships, even if they weren't under the exact same roof. Remember, you know, one time it was, well, if you can't put them all together, put them in homes that are next door to each other. So at least they can share a backyard. So things like that was a creative workarounds to really put the child front and center rather than looking at a child as just a checklist that you have to go through.
Yeah. Well, per your website, just found it. You guys said that in 2002 in Tennessee, less than 35% of siblings groups were living together while in state custody, of course, compared to 75% were together in 2015. I think that's excellent.
Yeah, that they did tremendous work. I mean, 35, can you imagine, you know, 70 some odd percent of your kids, 65% of your kids coming in, just getting ripped from their parents?
Well, this is the fact that it happens to one kid is unacceptable. And then now there's this whole new level of, well, was it necessary in the first place? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, now it's like all of these stats, I mean, they were people in the first place, but now it's not, oh, well, they tried to save this kid, but maybe, you know, they get screwed with these statistics about foster kids not graduating high school, being homeless, having depression, you know, being more likely to have addiction issues because of self-medicating mental health issues that weren't taken mm-hmm. care of. But you know what? I mean, they saved a bunch of other kids. But now if it's like they didn't need to be exposed to these potential trauma situations in the first place, I'm even more concerned as a parent. I'm super concerned.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier with, you know, 60% of children are removed for neglect. There's no need for that. There's no need to expose. So we know that removal from a home is an adverse childhood experience. That in and of itself is a form of trauma. So even if a child was not exposed to abuse or neglect, they now have that adverse childhood experience just by virtue of coming into the foster care system. And we know the outcomes for foster care are very grim. I mean, you just listed off many of them. You know, we have low high school graduation rates, 3% go on to graduate from a 4-year college. You know, the homelessness rates, the foster care to prison pipeline, the pregnancies, teenage pregnancy rates, all of these consequences of having your life uprooted and not having your needs met. And when you put it into context, it's of course, you know, these kids are being put into precarious situations, constantly not knowing what their future holds. You know, if that doesn't need to be the case, then it should not be.
Well, per that, for our listeners, what are some, you know, unbiased pros and cons of either perspective on how to fix this, both the reform the system and abolish the system viewpoints? You know, being someone who's had this in-depth look into the picture, what are the pros and cons of both those perspectives?
So I think everyone agrees that there needs to be reform. Abolition is one version of how that reform could look. But everyone agrees there needs to be reform. And pretty much everyone agrees that the reform needs to start right at the front end. So the question is, what brings a family to the attention of the Child Protective Services in the first instance? This is different in every state. The individual laws and policies will vary from location to location, but it would require the agencies and the states and the policymakers to really take a hardline look at what those policies are and how they are implemented in practice. Are they really promoting classist and racist undertones, either covertly or overtly? Or are they really trying to ensure that we are helping families stay together and helping families in crisis overcome those times of crisis, and really only using foster care as a short-term emergency situation the way it was designed to be? And the pros and cons of the abolition is that really, if you are truly treating child welfare as this family-oriented service, where a family is unable to meet their child's needs for whatever reason, the agency assists the family, goes and works with the family, finds out what that family's strengths are, finds out the areas that the family could use support, and finds ways to support the family. And therefore, the family is left in a better situation than they were when they came into contact with the child welfare agency. They never reach that point of crisis, or if they did reach the point of crisis, it's promptly ameliorated. And the child stays at home with their parents or with their family intact, in whatever that looks like for that family. So there is a position, which by the way is how it should work anyways. The problem is that when CPS initially interacts with a family, if the family is already at a point of crisis, the CPS or investigator or agency worker has to make a decision: is this child in imminent danger right now, or can we work to ameliorate whatever the needs are while the child's at home? Or are we so deep into this crisis that the child is not safe right now, in which case we put the child in foster care only for as long as it takes to ameliorate the safety conditions so the child can come home? I mean, at the end of the day, that's the only point of foster care. It's only to make sure the child's in a safe place right now, so that we can work with the family to find out how to support their needs to make it safe for the kid to come home. Foster care was never designed to be this long-term system where kids are growing up in these facilities. That's what it's evolved into over the years, unfortunately. So the abolish foster care is there a way to do that more efficiently where the family never reaches the point of crisis? Can we make sure that the family is supported with the child at home such that the child never has to go into foster care?
Okay. I thought it was just get rid of the system completely, a very just like radical dismantling concept.
That could be. There are a lot of different groups taking a lot of different positions, but typically what I've heard is, when we're saying abolish foster care, we're not abolishing child welfare, we're abolishing foster care. There's no reason to remove the child, to put the child in a stranger's home when they could have stayed home with their parents, that there had been better community-based supports.
Okay. Well, per the safety part, there's a couple more stats I learned for the first time from digging into you guys that really freaked me out. And one of them is about the use of psychotropic drugs. Mm-hmm. So this is from my own experience in the quote unquote troubled teen industry, you know, the cult spun, tough love jazz, you know, drugging or not using drugs, one or the other, is incredibly common. And I was on Ritalin since before I can remember, of course. But these are psychotropic drugs. So firstly, for those of us who don't know, what's the difference between psychotropic drugs and just like, is Ritalin a psychotropic drug, or are you talking about something bigger than that?
Ritalin. When we talk about psychotropic drugs, we're talking about any medication that can alter your mental functioning. I mean, and so that's sort of a very broad umbrella term that includes all medications that are designed to change the way you think or function.
Right. Well, per the 2010 Tufts research that you guys posted, they said that 4% of the general population in the youth age group was on psychotropic drugs. 4%, that's single digits. And they said that foster kids were between 13 to 52% were on psychotropic drugs and that some of those were not even approved by the FDA. Like, how, what is that? How is that possible?
Yeah, it's terrifying, isn't it? So what we see, and we see this time and time again, is that when children come into foster care, they often have a history of trauma. The removal from their home in and of itself is a source of trauma. So these young people have trauma backgrounds. Oftentimes they have mental or behavioral health needs as a result of their trauma background. But what we don't see is a real commitment to ensure that these young people's mental and behavioral health needs are being met in a comprehensive and trauma-informed way. So we're not, unfortunately, we're seeing the child welfare agencies using psychotropic medications as a form of behavior control, a chemical straitjacket, if you will, because the young people are exhibiting symptoms of their trauma. And rather than meeting it with trauma-informed therapy, they just drug the behavior to control the kids, to make them calmer, to make them more docile, to make them easier to handle and therefore easier to house. And it's, you see, like the side effects of some of these medications are serious. You know, there's implications. There's a higher instance for diabetes, for heart conditions. There's a whole laundry list of really serious side effects. Some of them are permanent that can affect kids that are on these medications. And what isn't reflected in the statistic is that many times kids are on multiple psychotropic medications. So it's not just that they're on one, they're on two, three, four. We've seen kids as young as six that are on three or more psychotropic medications, and no one can seem to tell us why. So we actually, I mean, we launched a whole case in Missouri specifically on just this issue, to make sure that children were not on multiple concurrent psychotropic medications. They weren't on medications at very young ages, that there was oversight onto these prescribing patterns to make sure that every medication that's being administered to a child was purposeful.
Okay, and so we're not only talking about sedating them, if you will, or just making them more complacent temporarily. If you're talking about six-year-olds, this is like pre-puberty on multiple psychotropics without a developed prefrontal cortex and these permanent, like lifelong, this damage. What? Like this is, they're literally breaking children's brains that are primarily low-income, at-risk children of color.
Yes.
This is horrifying. This is dystopic.
It is absolutely dystopic. So our campaign, I use Missouri as our most recent example because it was specifically focused on this, is too much, too many, too young. So we see foster kids that are on too much, meaning that the doses are just too high for this young person's body to handle. Too many, meaning they're on multiple medications at the same time, or too young, meaning there's no medically indicated reason that this young person should be on these medications. And I want to be careful here because it's not that a lot of times young people will come into foster care and they don't necessarily have medical records. They move around from home to home a lot. So there's different foster parents bringing them to different doctors and nobody really has the big picture look at what's happening to this young person's life. So we're not trying to point the finger at any one pediatrician or any one foster parent, because oftentimes these are folks that are doing the best they can with the information that they have, which is often nothing. But we had a story in Missouri about a young person that came to their foster home with a tissue and a handful of pills wrapped up in a tissue. And she just shows up at the new foster home. And the foster mother's looking at this tissue and going, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to administer these medications. And there's no medical records. And there's no instructions. And what do you do in that situation? How is there not an oversight process to make sure that this isn't happening to thousands and thousands of young people?
Well, especially if the reason most of these kids are in state care is because their parents were neglectful. The state is seeming is pretty neglectful for talking about this is a medical issue. This is a health issue. And then, yeah, I'm just, my mind is kind of blown on this one, to be honest, with the drugs. Like the drugging is pretty horrifying. And then when we talk about what, the reason I ask you, do children really even have rights? Is this true? It's like, what about the body autonomy? What about the medical autonomy here? These kids don't even get a choice. I've watched videos on your YouTube with a ton of adults from different places talking about how their childhood, they would never want to relive it. It was like being a zombie with all the drugs they were on. I saw that montage of all the different voices that were all on five different random drugs each, you know, as children. And this is kind of incredible.
Yeah, that was hard to watch. And that's so that's exactly what we're talking about is very, I mean, one of the policies that we advocated for in Missouri was informed assent and informed consent. So there was no clear delineation on who makes the decisions on behalf of the young people in foster care and whether or not young people themselves have the voice to say no. And so those were almost novel concepts, believe it or not. And so that those were policies that really had to get hammered out, and thankfully they have. And then just basic medical records. You know, it seems so simple, but when you don't have the bio parent taking the child to the doctor every time that just has that knowledge base of the child's background, it's imperative that you have a comprehensive medical record. So you know what drugs a kid has been on, how they responded, what their dose was, what their medical allergies are. How can you even begin to try to treat a child when you don't even know what their medical allergies are? I mean, some of this stuff just seems too basic to be real, but it is real and it's happening every day.
Well, I mean, so outside of foster care, it sounds like, and I'm pretty sure it's long overdue that we have a conversation on a larger scale about what children's rights really are and at what point someone has the right to be, have consent or assent in their treatment, whether it be the drugs that they're forced to swallow or the kinds of therapies they're forced to endure. I mean, look at conversion therapy. That's another thing I want to make sure that we touch on at the end of this. Like, I want to make sure we talk about this next is the stat. Oh my gosh, let me pull it up so I'm not wrong, because this was incredible. You guys are crazy. So it said that I highlighted it. No, this was crazy. 31% of children in foster care identify as LGBTQ.
So I think the national statistic is give or take 1 in 10. So we're seeing huge disproportional representation of the LGBTQ community within the foster care system. And obviously these statistics are likely undercounts, that there's absolutely no real way to measure. That's not like we're, it's not something that's information that's collected and aggregated. So I just want to throw that caveat out there. But yeah, there's huge overrepresentation of the LGBT community in foster care. And there's a variety of reasons for that across the country. But we need to make sure that, like, all of these issues are intersectional. So we need to make sure that young people's needs are being met and that young people are being placed in safe and affirming placements, that they have mental and behavioral health that is consistent with what their needs actually are and what their personal journeys actually are. In recent legislation that was passed, there was without going too much into details, and all the information's on our website if anyone wants to go dive down this rabbit hole. In 2018, there was federal legislation passed called Families First, and it changed the funding streams in some pretty fundamental ways to try to promote family preservation. And one of the things that it authorized was funding revenue sources for certain types of therapeutic services, but they have to be legitimate therapy sources for the exact reason you mentioned. We don't want to be sending kids to conversion therapy and calling it therapy and saying that we complied with the federal law or anything like that. These have to be actual, verified legitimate therapy.
Well, per that point, have you found children within the foster care system that were sent to any sort of conversion therapy?
Because of our children's rights and we do typically state level class action, we don't do direct representation of young people in the system. So, I mean, we wouldn't directly be handling those cases, but we've heard anecdotally that young people have struggled with being ostracized by not having safe and affirming placements, by not having meaningful trauma-informed therapy, the whole range of the gamut.
So per the separation of church and state, are children within the foster care system ever being sent to religious placements, like in these religious programs or nonprofits that are religious?
I think the answer is no. The caveat is that a lot of the partnerships, a lot of the groups that work in the child welfare space, a lot of the organizations, the nonprofit organizations that facilitate a lot of these services are faith-based organizations. So they're not, indoctrinating children into their faith system, but they can be selective on the programs that they choose to administer.
Well, also their faith base is going to influence the kind of programs that they're creating, right? So from that perspective, is that what you're saying?
Yes. And the type of client that they're going to work with. So one of the concerns, and there was a lawsuit that was brought in South Carolina recently that alleged discrimination against prospective LGBTQ foster parents and adoptive parents. So we don't want to see faith-based community partners selecting who can be a licensed foster parent, who can be approved as an adoptive parent. And for young people who identify as members of the LGBTQ community, you want to make sure that you feel safe confiding in your caseworker to what your needs genuinely are and whether your needs are genuinely being met. And we don't want the knowledge that your caseworker is employed by a faith-based community that may frown upon you and your existence to be a chilling factor in you voicing your needs. If you need something, your caseworker is the person that is supposed to ensure that that is being taken care of, that you are getting the mental, physical, behavioral, educational support that is appropriate for you. And so, while no, I think the answer to your question is, are children being placed in these overtly indoctrinating residential facilities? No, but we do see it infiltrating in other ways that we want to be very careful about. So the executive order was a couple weeks ago. I mean, most of the stuff in the executive order, I'm really encouraged to see that the administration is putting an emphasis on family preservation for all of the reasons we've talked about at length today, making sure that children don't unnecessarily come into foster care in the first place. We do want to make sure that if agencies are partnering with faith-based communities, that the faith-based community is not imposing their beliefs onto the young people they serve or onto the families or onto prospective foster and adoptive families, that they are truly executing their role in the best interest of the child with fidelity. And that is something we speak to a lot. That is something we watch very closely. It's something we give trainings about. So if it's something that you're more interested in, for sure follow us, and you can get real-time updates on all of the work that we do for foster youth and all systems-dependent youth in the LGBTQ community, and can use that avenue to reach out to us if there's a particular issue area that needs to be brought to our attention.
Cool. I'm sure people definitely will. Last point I wanted to make sure we went over with you, because it's the reason that we all got connected, is your review nationally of Sequel Youth and Family Services, who owns Lakeside Academy, where Cornelius Frederick was murdered on my birthday this year. So what can you tell us about Sequel? What have you guys found? What have you been involved in? What are we looking at here?
So Sequel is a national for-profit company that runs a series of congregate care facilities in 21 states across the country. As you mentioned, they ran the facility at Lakeside, where Cornelius was killed. They run a series of congregate care facilities in the state of Alabama. They run a couple in Iowa, just as examples. So obviously we are present in Michigan, and there's an active investigation ongoing in Michigan, and three of the individuals who were involved in Cornelius's death have been arrested. And immediately after his death, the state of Michigan Child Welfare Agency revoked Sequel's license for housing foster children, and all foster children were immediately removed from that facility. In Alabama, there was an investigation performed by the Protection and Advocacy Group, ADAP. I don't know if you guys know, in every state, there's a Protection and Advocacy Group, and it is a group that is tasked by law to advocate on behalf of individuals with disabilities who may not have the ability to self-advocate. And so they have the authority to do inspections of any residential centers where individuals with disabilities reside. They don't need a warrant. They don't need to announce themselves. They have the ability to do unannounced inspections. So ADAP, the Protection and Advocacy Group in Alabama, launched an investigation into the Sequel facilities there and produced a report that is heartbreaking to read. There were findings of fecal matter in some of the bedrooms of the children that were living there. There were blood smears on the windows. The bedrooms were nothing more than a thin mattress on a wooden frame. They weren't proper beds. The floors were cracked. Everything was dirty. The floorboards were broken. The worst is they notified the facilities of the licensing violations, but when they returned, nothing had changed. There's the same fecal matter on the floor of the same bedroom. There's still broken floors and barren walls, and there's photos on the report, which is, you know, it's online, it's on our website. The photos are hard to look at. These are places that you wouldn't want your child to spend an hour inside of, let alone live there. And so they produced this report, and so Children's Rights joined a coalition of advocacy groups and sent a demand letter to the state to ameliorate these conditions immediately. And to date, the state has committed to cease the use of restraints, inappropriate restraints. And so we'll see what comes of that. We're very hopeful that we can improve the conditions in some of these facilities for the kids there.
So it sounds like it's not an isolated incident. It wasn't just one Sequel facility in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that's been an issue for foster kids nationally.
It hasn't appeared to be an isolated incident. About a year ago, our executive director, Sandy Santana, did an interview with NBC about a different Sequel facility in Clarinda. And we spoke out about the conditions. Clarinda was a girls' facility, about the abuse that the residents there were experiencing. And that was over a year ago. And then this investigation was occurring in Alabama. Meanwhile, Cornelius is killed in Michigan. So this does seem to be an ongoing trend.
Yeah, I definitely recommend that everybody hop on YouTube. We definitely have that NBC thing in our playlists. Didn't even put two and two together that he was with your team, but that specific NBC layout, they're not even just covering Clorinda. They're covering multiple other states and multiple other programs. And that jazz includes like literal rape, you guys. Like there were literally children like that. And there were children from foster care in Texas that were sent up there as well. And abuse. So, well, this will be fun with SQL. Yeah, I guess last point that I wanted to make sure everybody knew that blew my mind from your website too. Well, you guys have dealt also with human trafficking. And it was something along the lines of, hold on before I just like totally make up a number in my head. Yeah, no, that was true. 60% of domestically trafficked children in the United States have a history in the child welfare system.
Yeah. And that may actually be a low end. So I've seen other statistics that have it as high as 85. There's obviously no way to know for sure. These are probably undercounts, but yes. So most domestically trafficked victims in the United States had at least one interaction with the child welfare system prior to their trafficking. So when we say we deal with trafficking is, we see human trafficking is one of the horrific results of a broken child welfare system. These are typically young people, typically young ladies that are recruited out of congregate care facilities, purposefully targeted, and then recruited, and then trafficked. And it is a cycle that we see that could be disrupted if we could disrupt the actual underlying issue of having vulnerable young people inappropriately placed in congregate care facility without having their needs being met.
Well, if congregate care facility is a gateway drug or a like recruiting ground for human sex trafficking, then is anybody safe in these places?
Well, as I said before, there are therapeutic group homes that are absolutely necessary and really do wonderful, engage in wonderful therapies for young people. And so I don't want to say that there's no need for congregate care. That would be a gross overstatement. But what we see, especially in the trafficking world, is you have young people that don't have that adult connection, that don't have that sense of home, that are have these vulnerabilities that the traffickers, I mean, this is a big business. These traffickers are intentionally targeting young ladies that they know have vulnerabilities, that have a need for family, that have a need to feel loved and wanted and cherished and supported. And they prey off of that vulnerability. They offer them this security, this false sense of security, this false sense of safety, this false sense of independence, and then manipulate that sense of security to traffic these young people. And oftentimes we'll see this cycle reoccurring, and sometimes it's the first time this young person has ever had their own income stream or has ever made a autonomous decision, or you know, so there's a lot that goes into fueling that insecurity.
Erin McGinnis, thank you so much for your time today. Obviously, this is a whole rabbit hole, and I hope we have many more conversations. Is there anything that you wanted our audience and our community to know, and or also how can they follow you guys and get involved again?
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you so much for having me. So I would encourage anyone that wants to know more about us, more about our work, that wants to get involved, to go to our website, childrensrights.org. We have a Families Over Facilities petition that's currently active on our website. You can sign the petition to encourage policymakers that every child needs a family and does not belong in a facility. we are also launching a new advocacy center, I think next week, in the coming weeks, which will immediately put you in touch with your local representative, with your federal representative. We'll have all of our petitions and our initiatives that you can sign on to. So definitely join our mail list or follow us on Twitter or Instagram to learn more about that and be the first to be notified with as soon as that goes live. And if there's any of these issues that you wanted to know more about that we talked about today and many more, as Miranda would say on our website, feel free to come check them out.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure everybody will go over and stalk, and you'll have all the new friends that we just love so much. So I really hope that we can see some genuine evolution in these systems. And thank you guys so much for everything you're doing to make this a better world for the kids.
Yeah, thank you.
See, wasn't that worth the wait? It really was, right? So definitely connect with Children's Rights, you guys. They've got, it looks like a virtual event. I just got an email on the 18th. Children's Rights has this really cool jazz going on. Ashton Kutcher, Mila Kunis, Rosario Dawson, all those guys will be there. So we're going to make sure that we have that info in the description of this episode as well and post it on all of our social medias. Please also subscribe to us wherever you listen to us, rate us, and write a review. It's really the only way that other people will stumble upon our podcast. So we appreciate you, and we hope to see you all out in Missouri or virtually for Right to Rights Rally this weekend. So make sure that you're checking out all this jazz on our website. And again, we do have a website now. It's talktroubled.org. And again, check out childrensrights.org. And thanks for listening.